Welcome to The Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Hello, hello, and welcome to another edition of The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Sarah Gon. Sarah, how are you?
Hi. Well, Nick, I think we both need the end of the week.
Indeed. I'm a bit tired and exhausted for some reason. I'm not really sure why, but maybe it's just the trials of, you know, facing
living
the
here.
Horror. Yeah, of what is going on to our beloved nation. and today we're going to be doing a little bit of a slimmed down version of the Daily Friend. Unfortunately, our colleague who was scheduled to be with us, Herman Pretorius, was not able to make it. So it's just going to be me and Sarah. And I think we'll do a little bit more of a slightly relaxed, slightly more wide-ranging conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, just talking about stuff that's going on. You've covered some of these stories before, but there's been some new developments here and there. So let's start off with something that, you know, we see a lot of in South Africa, and this is more regulation and more economic policy, social policy, more legislation. Now, unlike most legislation and regulation that come in South Africa, this one is being proposed by the DA government in the Western Cape. Western Cape Premier Alan Windey says the province plans to change their deadly relationship with alcohol by amending the Liquor Act in the province. He says there's lots of data to support a casual relationship, or causal relationship rather, sorry, I'm not informed today, between alcohol abuse in communities and violence. He then went on to say, quote, "That is why we are instead pursuing more targeted interventions by amending the Western Cape Liquor Act. These amendments will directly and indirectly reduce alcohol harms as well as improve the efficiency of the Western Cape Liquor Authority." He said he went on to explain that banning alcohol was going to be very dangerous for the economy in the province, because, of course, you know, it's a big wine producing province. So he doesn't want to do anything like that. But they included a new number of regulations. Some of these were things like confiscating seized liquor after a payment of the admission of guilt fine, inserting an objective test within the act to determine whether alcohol has been sold to an unlicensed outlet or individual, obliging license holders to take reasonable measures to determine that a client is of drinking age, expanding Section 24 committee powers to hear enforcement matters, ensuring that a record of all liquor sales is kept by outlets and prescribes the measure of detail required, limiting the delivery of more than the prescribed limit of liquor by inserting a requirement to produce the written consent of the presiding officer. So, you know, a lot of technical stuff there, but basically stuff that will make it harder to sell alcohol generally, and also presumably easier to enforce. Sara, what's your sort of first take on this? I mean,
I think it's quite interesting, because I think what Alan Windey's trying to do is respond to the fact that without a doubt, the banning of alcohol had a positive effect on a whole lot of negative issues like abuse, like car accidents and trauma resulting therefrom, and which, you know, makes logical sense.
Our CEO, yeah, Frans Cronier, made a, you know, he said several times actually on this show about that we underestimate, because we're so used to it, the enormous effect of alcohol on our society.
Mm. Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, I think so much is aggravated, criminally is aggravated by the consumption of alcohol. I think what he's trying to do, because I don't think he can make a huge impact, but I think what he's trying to do is to tighten everything administratively, so that the Western Cape government, to the extent that it can tighten the rules, be much more cautious about who they give licenses to, where they give them license to operate, how close they are. I mean, I think the one thing in the States, it seems to be, if films are anything to go by, you know, the obligations on owners of pubs and things to check the age of the people coming in and buying liquor seems to be quite significant. Now, I assume that's because the penalty for not doing so must be quite considerable.
No, that was definitely my experience in the US. Yeah. Everywhere you go, even if you're like, basically, if you look like you're under 50, they ask you for photo ID.
Mm. Well, very flattering. But I mean, the thing is that as I say, he's trying to do as much as he can within the confines of what the government can actually do. And that's what I mean about tightening up. Look, I think the other area, and I don't know to what extent he's has control over, is obviously better enforcement of drunken driving. And that probably requires making penalties for drunken driving much more severe and much more immediate. But most of it is not so much about the law as the enforcement of the law. The problem is that for a whole lot of physiological, biological reasons, we get drunk very, very easily. And that doesn't deal with, if alcohol still be allowed, which it's almost impossible not to, it doesn't deal with the issues of gender-based violence, of violence on the streets. That becomes a whole different issue and has to be dealt with in a completely different way. And to that extent, government's role is more peripheral in involving a whole lot of groups that can have an impact sociologically.
Right. So my take on, I'm tend to be suspicious of this kind of government regulation stuff. We've seen it in the past before. The DA government in the Western Cape can be a bit nanny state-ish sometimes. Mm. It's got a quite technocratic view of how government should run. And I do fear that with this, we'll have the same problem that we have with a lot of regulations in South Africa, which is that people who already sort of follow the law, fairly established businesses, fairly responsible business owners, that kind of thing, will follow these new regulations, to the letter. And it'll make it harder for them to do business, while the parts of the country that they're not easy to police, will just ignore it. And that's where the problem is already.
Absolutely.
I can't imagine that sort of, maybe a Shebeen or something protected or controlled by a gang in the Cape Flats is going to take these very seriously.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's one of the places where the problem is, because, it's not, for the most part, journalists aside, it's not the middle class and the wealthy who are causing law enforcement problems in for the most part anyway. So I'm a little bit skeptical with this, and like you said, this is kind of trying to fix the things that government can fix, because the much bigger problems here are these sort of deep social problems, the kind of entrenched drinking cultures, binge drinking cultures we have in parts of the country, the casual connection between sort of violence and drinking, the fact that South Africa is just generally a very violent place. I mean, we're definitely in the top 10 of the most violent countries in the world, and those problems are much more complicated, and they're related to all sorts of things: family breakdown, bad socioeconomic conditions, like the fact that there's no jobs, gangs in some places. So it's very much a kind of stopgap kind of thing in that sense. And I worry that it won't be particularly effective and will hurt the economy, economy that's been decimated by the lockdown.
Yeah. Well, you see, this is where my point about enforcement comes in. If you really want to have any impact, it's not about enforcing it against the legal distributors or pub owners who do what they're required, who have the licenses. It's about the guys that are almost impossible to police. You don't want to make the other guys' lives more difficult. But if there are things like, I know they are in Gauteng, where you have liquor outlets like not, across the road from schools. I mean, there's no excuse. And not to say that kids can't go down can't go a kilometer further on and buy alcohol. But I suppose the combination of not having it outside the school and someone feeling, that they actually have to check the ID of, it's a little bit, it may have some impact. But that's the limitation for government.
Right. And yeah, so I think this is smarter than some kinds of regulation they could have gone with here. I know that the ANC in Gauteng, I think, has talked about sort of much more stringent bans. I know the ANC nationally has talked about raising the drinking age, which is such a non-solution. It's actually spectacular because if the problem is underage drinking, that means they're already ignoring the law.
Exactly. So now it means that people who are 19 will ignore the law as much as people who are 17.
Right. So these are better than those solutions.
Limitations. Let's put it that way.
Right. I think to a certain degree, though, the reality is we actually, until the police force and the national police force, I mean, not just the sort of provincial and municipal police forces, until the national police force is working properly, and until we, you know, are actually generating hope in the country through, you know, jobs and opportunities and that kind of stuff, you can regulate as much as you like, and you're not going to fix the binge drinking problem. You're not going to fix the violence problem.
And I think particularly after pandemic, and this has nothing to do with how the government responded to the pandemic, but, you know, you will have increases in suicide, in aggression, in alcoholism by virtue of people feeling isolated, lonely, disconnected. Mm. So, you know, while you may sort of help to fix with one hand, the problem will get greater for other reasons. It's a problem that will probably live with us forever.
Indeed, or at least for a while.
At least while the ANC is government.
Yeah, look, we're going to fix probably all of South Africa's problems before we fix this one, because this is the one that's going to be very difficult to get rid of. What's quite interesting, I think, is actually just before we move on, I think the US is interesting in that there are some interesting parallels, and I think they have an unhealthy binge drinking culture there too, even though they're obviously much wealthier than us. My experience of hanging out with Americans is that especially younger Americans drink way too much. And you know, there's differing regulations based on different states there, and yet still doesn't seem to be an approach that's fully worked. So I suspect that we will encounter some of the same problems because there's a bad way of going about drinking in this country that needs to change. Anyway, let's go on to a story that we have talked about before. And this is the government's decision to buy 260 million rands worth of the allegedly antiviral drug interferon from Cuba in particular. We've talked about this before and how it was a complete waste of money. Some of this portion of this drug was completely wasted when the Defence Force forgot to put it in the fridge.
And I think it was about 90 million rands worth.
Right. It was a serious problem.
Huge, my
camera seems to stop working. Yeah, there we go. It's fixed. So that was bad. And now this caused questions, and the Minister of Defense and some officials from the Department of Defense appeared before the Portfolio Committee in Parliament to actually talk about, you know, how this had all happened. So there's been further details that have emerged. One is that normal procurement processes were sidestepped. And the minister claims that she didn't know this was happening. And the Department of Defense said that they needed to, you know, act quickly and buy this stuff as fast as they could and sidestep the normal protocols because they were, quote, facing biological warfare when the COVID-19 pandemic struck, which is... There's some interesting implications from that turn of phrase. It also then emerged that this drug doesn't work at all, or at least not according to the South African Health Products Regulatory Authority. And so far, of the 260 million rands worth of interferon, only 10 vials of it have been used and on one person. The rest is still in cold storage in Pretoria. A bit of a mess. You heard the minister say something in particular, though, didn't you, Sara?
She essentially approved it. She was persuaded by I don't know whom that it was it would be a good thing for the army to have. She didn't realize that the drug was not registered in by any of the authorities, both SAPRA and the Defence Forces Medical Authority. That didn't come into the equation. She didn't think of that. And it was to boost their immune system. It wasn't obviously going to be a cure, but it was to boost their immune system. Now, I mean, interferon used to be used particularly for things like hepatitis, and I know someone who was on it, but it hasn't really been used for years. She didn't know that it actually is in the country. And, you know, she kind of went on the word of someone saying it was okay and it was good and it was useful. And for that, she was prepared to allocate 260 million rand to have it brought in from Cuba. And so what do you have? You have the beauteous idea that, first of all, they bring in a drug they are not authorized to bring in at a huge amount of money, has no effect whatsoever. The army is not waging any more of a, what did you call it, a bacterial war, biological war. They are, we are too. And I mean, it's just, she got into trouble for giving people lifts to Zimbabwe, which was, you know, the sort of latest thing prior to everything else she got into trouble for. People have been suggesting, I think it was Peter Bruce who suggested that Ramaphosa must reshuffle his cabinet, which is a dreadful idea. Reshuffle, it means all you're doing literally is changing, moving around the chairs on the Titanic.
Right.
But she should actually go. I mean, this is, this is a damn army, for God's sake. And then, of course, you had the laughable thing, which we joked about, where the Hawks went to uplift the stock because, and they had a warrant to do so, and they were met by the army armed to the teeth to prevent them from coming in. I mean, this is so pathetic. She must go.
And the South African Defence Force definitely needs to, you know, it needs to be in better shape. I mean, it should always be in better shape because, you know, the army is one of the things the state is supposed to run normally and properly anyway. But, you know, we do actually have some sort of foreign policy threats now with the insurgency in northern Mozambique. So this kind of just total incompetence and waste is not so good.
I call it Keystone Brigadiers. You know, it's actually in its ludicrousy, it's bad news, and the government has sort of been. I mean, if Jacob Zuma or anyone else wants to commit a coup, they haven't got great material to work with.
Right. We may, if we have time, get onto a story about that a little bit later. but it's also kind of the sort of shrugging attitude that the minister and the officials seem to have. It's like, oh, well, you know, oops. That's 260 million rand, and I mean, if I was to speculate wildly, I think that what probably happened here is perhaps someone connected to the Cuban government who was looking to offload the interferon called up the greatest suckers in the world, which is who are in love with Cuba, and they said, "Oh, comrade, so good to speak to you. By the way, we've got all this stuff. We'll give it to you for a great price. You just need to wire us the money."
The second part of the contract with doctors. You know, we've got the doctors. Right. Now we'll take your useless drugs. I mean, the Cubans must have seen us coming and thought, "Oh my God, another one of them born every day." You know, it's actually incredibly embarrassing, and for her to retain her position. I mean, it is absurd. And, of course, the other thing that's absurd is the very fact that they couldn't even store it from between 2 degrees, not minus two, 2 degrees and 8 degrees, your average fridge temperature.
Right.
In fact, warmer than your average fridge temperature. It's an embarrassment of cringing proportions.
I think that's definitely the right word. Yeah, I remember, you know, our defense force is often, I mean, this comment about biological warfare, I wonder what that means, because I've heard from people who have interacted with the South African Defense Department before these stories that, you know, I don't know if they're true, but they're still kind of interesting because I've heard a couple of different ones in them, which is about how some people in the Defense Department, particularly the more political figures, have this kind of paranoid fear of imminent American or CIA invasions or coups or that kind of thing. So when you start talking about biological warfare, I mean, I wonder if there's some of the reasoning behind that is they sort of think, oh, well, you know, maybe I mean, it's the CIA behind this, yeah. Which would be very in keeping with how the ANC looks at the world.
We're in the realm of QAnon, yeah.
Indeed, of a sort. That's the funny thing is, you know, the QAnon people in America, the world came down around their heads after the Capitol riot there. And yet, the ANC has been as crazy and as paranoid about the world for a very long time.
But it is. I think the thing is that it is embarrassing because it's everything about it just screams ignorance.
Right. Or the sort of romantic, nostalgic view the ANC has about Cuba, which
is very strange considering the Cuba's sort of. Liberalizing economically. I mean, I would have thought that would have struck into the hearts of the ANC as virtually treasonous, but we'll see.
Well, who knows? Speaking of embarrassing, hospitals in the UK have begun to change from using the term breastfeeding chest feeding. And there was a study in the US a couple of years ago, a bunch of US academics, as academics are wont to do occasionally, they produce sort of strange studies. I saw one of my colleagues posted a thing today that someone from Harvard did a study claiming that reparations to Black Americans would have reduced COVID deaths, which is, I'm just going to say, points for being topical. But I think it's a bit of a stretch. Anyway, it's not the point of our story today. They published a study in which they argue that the promotion of breastfeeding as the natural way to feed a child has many negative social effects. So these UK hospitals, that's the Brighton and Sussex University hospitals in the UK, have now officially said that we're going to be talking about chest feeding. We're not going to be talking about mothers. We're going to be talking about birthing people in an effort to include those who identify as non-binary or transgender. We are concerned about breastfeeding promotion because that praises breastfeeding as the natural way to feed infants, wrote Jessica Martusi of the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine and Anne Barnhill of John Hopkins University in the journal Pediatrics. Promoting breastfeeding as natural may be ethically problematic and even more troubling. It may bolster this belief that natural approaches are presumably healthier. Okay, so there's a lot of things to deconstruct there. Yes, natural things aren't always healthier, but in this case, I believe the medical advice is still that breastfeeding tends to be better for infants than the alternatives.
The advice tends to be that it's a better alternative. It's not that other alternatives can't be used. Very often they have to be. But you know, it's going from the bizarre to the core blimey, because you've basically had this ethos going through that breast is best. Now you don't want to refer to breast because it doesn't cover women who were not born women, and so you've got to have chest feeding, which of course is absolute and utter nonsense. In fact, I think the feminists should be actually quite offended by it, because only women can breastfeed, and even then some struggle, so they have to go on to the other stuff. But to contort this whole sort of philosophical idea of being egalitarian and not hurting people who are non-binary and or transgender, it's caving into not 1% of the population of either America or of the UK. And you can't dictate the sociology of a country by virtue of the state of less than 1% of the population in any area. And it's so embarrassing.
Honestly, I've had friends who at a point in their life have identified as, you know, non-binary and had, you know, a complicated relationship with their view of themselves. But that didn't mean that, you know, that's fine, whatever. That's them. That's their own life. Mm. But this is not how someone feels about themselves. It's not how someone interacts with people in their social life.
Exactly.
This is about a hospital delivering medical requirements to people. And as we know, there are very real differences between men and women. And by mushing up all these terms and confusing things and blurring the distinctions between the very real distinctions between the sexes, because this is not just about gender. I mean, they always talk about gender being a social construct.
Yeah.
And whether or not that's true, everyone except for the most fringe radicals believes that sex is not a social construct.
Yeah, and it's not. It's a biological determinant.
And the fact now that that hospitals are sort of being drawn into this. Has anyone demonstrated that the use of the word breastfeeding was causing any real psychological harm? This is we often have these word controversies, right, where some word is deemed to be offensive to some group. But there never seems to be anyone who does the work to prove that it is actually hurtful to a group of people. Sometimes it's literally a single individual claiming this doesn't sit well with me.
Yeah. Well, you see, there's something about the idea of that everything is being is going around gender issues to the extent that a lot of powerful voices in the gay community are becoming offended because some of the transgender claims are effectively denying that men can be gay. And lesbians are responding to the fact that, you know, lesbians are women, and that they're somehow being denied the right to be women by the same grouping. So what you're starting to see is moves towards the gays and the lesbians getting out of the LGBTQ acronym. So now you're going to have BTQ. You know, it's just ridiculous. And in reality, you know, but there is a norm. A norm in the sense that the vast majority of people are healthy. The vast majority of people are male or female, etc. There are people who are disabled for some reason, who have a genetic problem, whose lives may be torn apart by what they are. And society, usually, if society is rich enough, tries to meet their needs and help the people who have to look after them. But the whole society doesn't revolve around the person with a disability or the particular disability, because it's a relative rarity. And that's how life works. You know, we are not biologically perfect. We are, as I said on another podcast, we are animals. I think it's partly sort of tied into this idea of working towards a socialist utopia, that somehow we are better than we think we are, and we just have to reach that point and we can all be equal. We can't all be equal on any terms whatsoever. There's so much that makes us different.
I think it was the American economist and intellectual Thomas Sowell likes to point out that even two twins, identical twins in the same family, often have very different life outcomes.
Absolutely.
When things are as common as they can be, just because the world is a very, very complicated place. I do agree with you, though, that what's behind this is a kind of attempt to a belief that human beings are this sort of clay that you can just mold into any shape you want.
Yeah.
And it follows from sort of, that Rousseauian thought, the French intellectual Rousseau, who believed that everywhere people are born free but are in chains, and that, you know, our sort of more inner self is the true thing, is the true thing that we just need to bring out, and then everyone will be fully liberated. But it's kind of in conflict with reality.
I think the problem is the reason that these ideas have taken off so much in places like America and UK is partly because those societies are victims of their own success. They're wealthy, right. People are healthy, people have access to more to improve their lives than ever before in history, right, in very, very large numbers. And you know, maybe they need to suffer a bit.
And it's not just materially as well. Those places are diverse in terms of any metric you can measure diversity by.
Absolutely.
You know, whether it be ethnicity, whether it be acceptance of gender or sexual identities or orientations or whatever, those places are genuinely fairly liberated places. I mean, my belief about the United States in particular is that it's a country where a space exists for basically every type of person in the world. There is a corner, there is at least two blocks of America where you as a person will probably find people exactly like you.
Absolutely.
And there's this constant game of pretending like, you know, these sort of wealthy countries really aren't that accepting. I mean, you know, maybe someone has a bad relationship with their parents or something, and there are still places where they face discrimination, but it's not the norm.
Well, as the writer as the writer Ayaan Hirsi Ali said, if you want to see discrimination and pain, travel. I think the problem is people are not, they don't actually know what's going on in the world.
Right. And you know, in South Africa, we really do feel, you know, we do still have real problems with that kind of thing. There are these horrible things like corrective rapes of lesbians in, you know, so-called corrective rapes of lesbians in poor areas of South Africa. And, you know, those are real problems that do need to be solved and will take a long time to fix.
But with all due respect, those are real problems.
That's it. That is a real problem. That's not, you know, calling it chest feeding.
so the chest feeders must travel.
Right. Let's fix those issues first, and then we can come talk return to this debate, thing. Perhaps. Anyway, send your hate mail to the comments below. And we will see you next week for another edition of The Daily Friend. We hope you enjoyed this one, thought it was interesting. We'll be back with a more normal format next week, and we'll probably have our CEO, Frans Krenia, on next Wednesday again. That's still not confirmed, but that's the plan to continue our discussion that we had about the life after the ANC. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for watching, and we'll see you next week. Have a great week, everyone.